Well, we do want to give thanks today to the Lord for His marvelous grace. And today, after our visit to discipleship last Sunday with Charlie Davis, we want to go back this morning and pick up the studies that Pastor Marcus has been doing in the book of Joshua, where we see the Israelites marching onward as the people of Yahweh. And so today, we want to go and continue on in this. And I have to have a light touch on this morning. And we see that the Israelites had come into the promised land. They had conquered the city of Jericho. And then they had gone up to the city of Ai, but had not really consulted the Lord and had failed to realize that sin took place in the people of Israel, where Jericho, as the first city to fall, was to belong entirely to God as His first fruits of the land. And when the people honored Him with the first fruit, then He would give them the rest of the land. But Achan, by stealing from God, disrupted that whole plan. When we look at the Israelites, when we look at the Canaanites, we see three basic responses throughout the book of Joshua. We started with Rahab, a woman of marvelous faith. And then we'll see later this morning the Canaanite leaders, who we learn at first are in fear and trembling because of the Israelites, and then are ready to attack and kill them all. Somewhere right in between these two extremes, we'll focus this morning on the people called the Gibeonites. If you don't know anything about the Gibeonites, that's just fine. Please, stay tuned. So here's Rahab. We've already looked at Rahab, a woman of marvelous faith who, when the spies came to her, acknowledged her faith in their God Yahweh, and prevented them from being taken by the Canaanites of Jericho. The Israelites marched around the city, the walls fell down, and Rahab was delivered. Well, God had told the Israelites to expel all of the Canaanites from the land. We don't have a detailed exception list to that, and a part of the instruction seems to be, because the Canaanites in the land will lead you astray to worship their gods, therefore you are to move them out. Rahab was a different sort of person. She was a person of great faith. As a matter of fact, she is a person who said these words. She said, "We have heard how Yahweh, using the name, the personal name of Israel's God, the I Am that God declared Himself to Moses, the He Is, or Yahweh, as Moses looked at Him, that He expounded His name to the people. We have heard how Yahweh dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt, and what you did to Sihon and Og, the two kings of the Amorites, east of the Jordan, whom you completely destroyed. When we heard it, our hearts melted in fear, and everyone's courage failed because of you." And then notice this last phrase, "For Yahweh your God is God in heaven above and on the earth below." Now, for Canaanite people and most people in the ancient world, that's an unusual concept. The usual concept is that there are many gods with very limited powers over limited areas, some in parts of the heavens, some in parts of the earth, some under the earth. But it takes all of those many gods in order for things to function. The message that God is communicating through His people Israel is that God is one, and He is in charge of all places and all things, and He seeks to show His love and grace to all. Interesting that Rahab understood that just through the news media and through the gossip that she heard. She had never met an Israelite before, and yet she deduced from all of that that this God of these people must be the real thing, and not a false imposter like all the gods of the Canaanites. Now, the New Testament reminds us of the great faith of Rahab. Hebrews 11, that great chapter of the Hall of Fame, Hall of Faith, reminds us that by faith the prostitute Rahab, because she welcomed the spies, was not killed with those who were disobedient. In James, James is emphasizing the importance of faith being manifested in actions. And so he also cites Rahab. In the same way, was not even Rahab the prostitute considered righteous for what she did when she gave lodging to the spies and sent them off in a different direction? In other words, Rahab was not just somebody who said, I believe, okay, let me get on with my life. She was somebody who put her faith into action. Even in addition to that, when we look at the Gospel of Matthew, when we look at the genealogy, we realize that Rahab didn't just remain a Canaanite, but was incorporated into the nation of Israel to the extent that she became an ancestress of King David. And not only that, but she became an ancestress of Jesus Christ, our Messiah. What a marvelous privilege for this woman who is a Canaanite, if you'll pardon the expression. Now, it shouldn't surprise us that God shows his grace to people in the world and not just to Israelites. If you go back to God's covenant with Abraham, he says to Abraham, I'll make you into a great nation and I'll bless you. I'll make your name great. You'll be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and whoever curses you, I will curse. And notice where this is all going. And all peoples on earth will be blessed through you. God's desire is to reach out to all people on earth. The prophet Isaiah looks to the end of time and sees this marvelous picture where there Yahweh will make himself known to the Egyptians and they will acknowledge Yahweh. Well, the Egyptians were enemies of Israel through most of their history. They will worship with sacrifices and grain offerings. They make vows to Yahweh and keep them. The Egyptians and Assyrians will worship together. The people to your south, the people to your north, in other words, all these nations around you will join you in worship. And then he goes on to say, Israel will be the third, along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing on earth. Yahweh Almighty will bless them, saying, Blessed be Egypt, my people, Assyria, my handiwork, and Israel, my inheritance. God is not eager to judge the Gentiles of the world. He looks forward to blessing them and showing them his grace. So we have a response of Rahab. The circle and the towns that you see in the left-hand side of the picture are the towns of Canaanite leaders that gather together to try to fight the Israelites to destroy them. Here you see the leaders gathering together to plot and to get ready to make war. And then they come ready to do conflict with the Israelites. Now it's interesting, when we first saw these leaders a few chapters ago in Joshua 5, notice the end of this verse. This starts out talking about the Amorite kings west of the Jordan, the Canaanite kings. Their hearts melted in fear, and they no longer had the courage to face the Israelites. But now we jump ahead to chapter 9, where we'll be this morning. And notice what's changed. Again, it starts by talking about all of these kings. And then it says they came together to wage war against Joshua in Israel. Now, we might ask the question, what happened between chapter 5 and chapter 9? That all of a sudden, these people who were terrified and shaking are now emboldened to attack and to try to kill Israel. We don't know all the answers to that, but one of the things that happens is the Israelites went against the town of Ai, and there, surprisingly, they were defeated. And it turned out they were defeated because of the sin of the man Achan that we talked about a moment ago. He had stolen from Yahweh. And so now the Israelites were not blessed by God as they went on to attack the next city. Achan and his whole family, all of their possessions, now became a part of Yahweh's inheritance since they had stolen from him, which is what happens when you steal, when you undergo cherem. Cherem in Hebrew may be equivalent to the Arabic word harem. And you know a harem in Arab countries. This is the bevy of girls that belong to the sheikh. And if you want to get in trouble and lose your head, you start messing with the harem of the sheikh. Jericho was Yahweh's, not harem, but the Hebrew word is cherem, belonging to Yahweh, and everything in Jericho was to be his. The punishment on Achan is not the standard for any other punishment that we ever see in the Old Testament. It's not a standard of righteousness. It is simply the idea that one who steals from God forfeits all that they are and have. Now, after that, the Israelites went forward and fought again the battle of Ai and then won. So we have these two groups. We have Rahab, we have the Canaanites who are opposed to the Israelites, but this morning I'd like to focus with you on the Midianites, and the Gibeonites rather, and these are the people who are in the middle. Now Joshua 9 is where this all begins. You see Gibeon here, not too far from Ai. Jerusalem would be just down here. It's kind of right in the center of all that the Israelites are going to be doing. And what happens is the leaders get together. Joshua 9, beginning at verse 3. When the people of Gibeon heard what Joshua had done to Jericho and Ai, they resorted to a ruse. They went as a delegation whose donkeys were loaded with worn-out sacks and old wineskins, cracked and molded. So they're going to engage in a kind of a subterfuge. And so here are these pitiful-looking people as they come to visit the Israelites in Gilgal. And the text goes on to tell us they put worn and patched sandals on their feet. They wore old clothes. All the bread of their food supply was dry and moldy. Then they went to Joshua in the camp at Gilgal and said to him and the Israelites, "We have come from a distant country. We're all worn out from our trip. Make a treaty with us. Make a covenant with us. We want to be on your side." Notice here the motivation seems to be not engaging in a ruse in order to try to get the upper hand or to trick the Israelites so that they can kill them, but they seem to realize that the Israelites have something that the other Canaanites around them do not. Now the Israelites are rightly a little suspicious, and so they said to the Hivites, "But perhaps you live near us, so how can we make a treaty with you?" They weren't supposed to make treaties with people who were near them in the land. They reply, "We are your servants." In other words, they're saying to them, "We want to be on your side. We want to be your allies." And so Joshua also seems suspicious. "Who are you? And where do you come from?" he asks. And so they answer, "Your servants have come from a very distant country." But notice the reason that they give again. You have little echoes of Rahab here. "Because of the fame, the name of Yahweh your God. For we have heard reports of him, all that he did in Egypt, all that he did to the two kings of the Amorites east of the Jordan, Sihon king of Heshbon and Og king of Bashan, who reigned in Ashtaroth." Notice they don't mention Jericho or Ai. These are intelligent people. "And our elders and all those living in our country said to us," and now this is the part that's truthful, "take provisions for your journey, go and meet them and say to them, we are your servants, make a treaty with us." Their desire is to join with the Israelites and also to join with their God. Now, I say the Gibeonites are kind of in the middle because what they're doing is not really kosher, if I can use that term. They are really engaging in a ruse, a subterfuge. We would call that really a lie. Now, in our culture today, it seems like lying is becoming much more popular and much more accepted. In other words, it almost seems like lying is a righteous thing to do. The Bible is not putting its stamp of approval on this lie. After all, the Ten Commandments are still there, and the commandment against bearing false witness against your neighbor, lying against your neighbor, is still in the Ten Commandments. But the Gibeonites seem to be people that want to know Israel's God and want to join with them, but they're not sure how to do it because they are afraid that they're simply lumped into the category of all of their neighbors. They're going to be exterminated. So they go on with the story. They talk about their bread being warm, how now you see how dry and moldy it is. These wineskins that we filled were new, but see how cracked they are with age. Our clothes and sandals are worn out. So the response is, the Israelites sampled their provisions, but notice what the text says. They did not inquire of Yahweh. And then Joshua made a treaty of peace with them to let them live, and the leaders of the assembly ratified it by oath. What we don't know is the what if. What if they had come and said, "We're really not from a far country at all. We're from the next town down the road. But we have heard about your God, and we want to worship him with you, and we want to be a part of you, because we are turning our backs on all the gods of the land of Canaan." If they had done that, we really don't know if the Israelites had inquired of Yahweh what he might have said. He might have said, "These people are like Rahab, accept them." He might have said, "These people are like the Gentiles that I've told you about that live further away, and if they come in those terms, accept them, take them, and join with them and tell them about me." We don't know the what ifs. What we do know is what happened here. 3 days later, the Israelites, as they were scouting around, saw this little town off about 3 miles away, and lo and behold, that was the city of Gibeon. That's where these people came from. They weren't from the other side of the world. They were 3 miles down the road. And so 3 days later, after they made the treaty, the Israelites heard that they were neighbors living near them. So the Israelites set out. And they're not happy campers. The leaders said to them, remember, we made a treaty with them. We made a covenant. We cannot attack them and kill them because we swore an oath by Yahweh our God. Now, it's interesting that the Gibeonites believed that the Israelites would honor their oath to their God. In other words, the Gibeonites seem to believe that this God of the Israelites is powerful enough and righteous enough and gracious enough that the Israelites will do what he says and will actually follow through. So then the leaders now have a problem because the people are grumbling. The word grumble is a word that we see a lot in the wilderness narratives. Whenever the Israelites moved and did something, some of the people were grumbling. And now there are people grumbling here. "Well, we should have killed them when we had a chance. They were in our camp. We could have gotten rid of them right now. Look, they lied to us. Let's attack them and kill them all." And the leaders reply by saying, "We've given them our oath by Yahweh, the God of Israel. We cannot touch them now. So here's what we're going to do. Let's let them live so God won't judge us. Let them live, but let them be woodcutters and water carriers in the service of the whole assembly." Notice how the language starts out. They'll be working for us. You know, here we just have a new reservoir of employees, and they will be serving us. So the leaders now had kept the oath. So Joshua now arrives in Gibeon, and he summons the leaders out. And they come out not with spears and swords ready to defend themselves or attack, but they come out humbly, ready to try to explain what was going on. And so Joshua meets them and he says to them, "What were you guys thinking? What in the world were you doing? And now you are under a curse." It's interesting that the curse seems to be what the Gibeonites were hoping for. "You will never be released from service as woodcutters and water carriers." Now notice that Joshua changes the terms a little bit. "For the house of my God." In other words, Joshua is saying to them, "We want you not just to be our personal servants, but we want you to get to know our God. You claim that you have heard about all that our God is doing, so your curse is that we're going to put you in a position where you can learn more about our God. And hopefully then you will become maybe more like the Rahab Canaanites than all those other Canaanites that are around." So the Gibeonites respond. And they don't say, "Oh, the deal is off. This wasn't what we signed up for." They respond to say, "Your servants were clearly told how Yahweh your God had commanded his servant Moses," they've learned quite a bit about the Israelites, "to give you the whole land and to wipe out all its inhabitants before you. So we feared for our lives because of you, and that's why we did this. We didn't want to die. We wanted to worship your God and to join with you." And so the end result is they say to Joshua, "So we are now in your hands. Do to us whatever seems good and right to you." In the next chapter, the other cities and their leaders around this in the land of Canaan will say that the Gibeonite men are some of the fiercest warriors and strongest fighters around. That's why they are scared to death when the Gibeonites join with Israel. This doesn't seem to be the response of people who are trying the subterfuge just to get the upper hand and then let the Israelites have it. This seems to be the response of people who genuinely are motivated to become a part of the people of Yahweh. So the result of all of this, Joshua saved them from the Israelites. Interesting that they had to be saved from the Israelites. They did not kill them. That day he made the Gibeonites woodcutters and water carriers for the assembly to provide for the needs of the altar of Yahweh. And then notice this phrase, at the place Yahweh would choose. This is the phrase that we see over and over again in the book of Deuteronomy about where eventually God will live when the Israelites come into the land. And then the author of Joshua sometime later says, and that's what's happening today. This came to pass. So here the Gibeonites, you see them working hard, laboring, not just for the Israelites, but for the altar. But think about God's grace. Joshua and the leaders did not inquire of the Lord. Now Joshua is a great hero of the faith. Over and over again, throughout the entire Pentateuch, going into the book of Joshua, and yet we're also reminded that he was not perfect. If you're thinking to yourself, well, I know I'm not perfect. I guess God could never use me. Remember that God uses imperfect people who desire to serve him and are ready to accept his grace and do what he wants. Joshua, I think, is a reminder to us that God can use not people who are rebelling against him, who are turning their backs on him, but God can use people who desire to serve him, even if they're not perfect all of the time. Now, I don't know about you, but I'm pretty thankful for that because I'm not perfect. I won't go into any details this morning. Please do not talk to Koila about all of this or anybody else. But I'm thankful that God uses imperfect people. But God also has showed his grace to the Gibeonites. Do you remember that phrase? The place Yahweh would choose? What happens is that the Gibeonites and the cities that are around them are basically incorporated into the tribe and the territory of Benjamin. This is Benjamin right here. Here's Gibeon. There are other cities that are around them. In other words, God brings them in as a part of the people of Israel. Wow, what a wonderful blessing that is. They become Israelites, in effect. And they are now given great responsibilities as well as privileges. But also the amazing thing is, when the Israelites come into the land, the city of Gibeon is the place where the altar of burnt offering is put, where the tabernacle, the tent of meeting, is put, so that Gibeon becomes an important place of worship for Israel. Long before Jerusalem is taken under King David, Gibeon is the place where Israelites go to worship. What an amazing honor. What an amazing privilege. Here's the Tell of Gibeon right here. The city today is nearby. The Tell is undergoing some excavations. But it's at Gibeon where the whole tabernacle, that is, the Israelites have followed in the wilderness, is now placed. And we see through in several passages in the book of Chronicles, we see statements like this. This is now a later time, David. David left Zadok the priest and his fellow priests before the tabernacle of Yahweh. And where is that, we ask? At the high place in Gibeon, to present burnt offerings to Yahweh on the altar of burnt offering. The altar of burnt offering is this place right here that goes with the tabernacle. Now, the Ark of the Covenant may have ended up somewhere different. There's various things going on until the temple is built in Solomon's reign. But they are to present burnt offerings to Yahweh on the altar of burnt offering regularly, morning and evening, in accordance with everything written in the law of Yahweh, which he had given Israel. The Gibeonites are not only sneaking in the back door of Israel, they are put front and center in an honored place where they will be an integral part of all the worship that is taking place. They are not simply kept separate from Israel, but they are incorporated into the whole family of Israel. And I think that's an important thought, because sometimes in our imaginations, when we think of reaching out to people and sharing Christ with them, sometimes we think of old patterns from days gone by, where if we just get people into the church, the preacher will preach a powerful sermon, and they'll be so convicted, they'll come down the aisle and kneel and pray to receive Christ, and then we can say, God bless you, go in peace, and that's it. What this is saying is, the way God normally works, is he works by bringing people into contact with other believers, so they can see not only our faith, they can see our life, they can see what it means to live the Christian life. And eventually, over some time, they will become much more receptive to receive Christ. In fact, that's actually what Brian is about to do on Wednesday nights in the program called The Gathering. To bring people from Berean for a meal, to invite people from the neighborhood, other people can be invited, friends of yours, so we can get to know them and they can see us and hopefully they can see our faith. That's probably why God has placed you in neighborhoods and jobs with friends and contacts all around, so that you can reach out to them, not just to get them in the doors of the church, but so that they can see how God is important in your life and they can see God's grace in action. It's amazing to me that this was going on with the Gibeonites. Remember the story of King Solomon? When he first began to reign, he prayed to God, and God appeared to him, and God said, ask me anything you want. And Solomon says, what I want more than riches and gold and power is wisdom. And so God granted him wisdom to rule. That took place at Gibeon. And it took place when Solomon and the whole assembly went to Gibeon there to the tent of meeting to worship. The bronze altar was there. The tabernacle was there. And so Solomon led the people in worship and sacrifices, and God appeared to him. That happened over and over again throughout the Old Testament. Now, the original Gibeonites were not the only people that we learn about, a couple of others in passing. A man by the name of Ishmaiah, who was a Gibeonite, we're told in 1 Chronicles 12, was one of David's right-hand man. He was a leader of the 30, as it was called. Even after the exile, centuries later, the Gibeonites were still there helping Nehemiah rebuild the walls. In other words, it seems like the plan to incorporate Gideon into the nation of Israel and into the faith of Yahweh worked pretty well. Now, God also came to their aid when they were attacked by the Canaanite armies. And when that happened in chapter 10, the Israelites also responded and honored their oath. We won't have time to go into all of chapter 10 today. It's a chapter of battles and war and killing and all those kinds of things. So if you would like to read that, go jump into chapter 10. But it also is a chapter when God does some amazing things. It's not just the Israelites against the Canaanites, but God sends hailstones from heaven. This is the chapter that talks about the sun and the moon standing still, Joshua's long day. We don't know exactly what that was. If you've heard stories of NASA or Princeton University finding a lost day in history, I'm sorry to say you've believed an urban legend, or we would call that today fake news. We don't know of anything at all like that. It's possible that God simply did something localized, which is the way he normally works at the time. It's also possible that this was more of a poetic account to celebrate the fact that God is really in charge. Joshua 10:10, Yahweh threw them into confusion before Israel, so Joshua and the Israelites defeated them completely at Gibeon. Joshua 10:14, there has never been a day like it before or since, a day when Yahweh listened to a human being. Surely Yahweh was fighting for Israel. What I think we really should glean from this is that God is ready to come to the aid of his people. Whether your need is fighting Canaanites, not too many of those still around today, even if they were, we should not fight them. But he comes to the aid of his people. Whether it's tragedies that come to us in life, whether it's suffering and sickness that comes to us in life, whether it's difficulties and despair that we face, God is gracious. And he is there ready to help us to follow him and to serve him through those times of need. This is what Anne read just a little bit ago in Psalm 102, just to pick out a few of the verses. Yahweh sits enthroned. He has compassion on Zion. The nations will fear the name of Yahweh. All the kings will revere your glory. So the name of Yahweh will be declared in Zion and his praise in Jerusalem when the peoples and the kingdoms assemble to worship Yahweh. God is in charge, and he wants to be in charge of our lives. So what does all this mean? What I'd like you to think about this morning is, first of all, has God ever used a situation in your life that was less than perfect? Joshua and the Israelites are not examples of what to do for every little detail, but God used them in great ways. If you think somehow God has set you aside because you have not done everything perfectly, then I would say to you this morning, think about Joshua and try to serve God as best you can. Think about this. Have you experienced God's grace? The Gibeonites, I think we would say, were wonderful recipients of God's grace that also served as motivation for them to serve him. They were faithful in serving the tabernacle and the altar of burnt offering. They were faithful in siding with the Israelites, not only for that generation that was delivered, but for generations afterwards. We experience the grace of God, and it's nice to say, thank you, Lord. I'll check back sometime later when I think about it. But hopefully God's grace should motivate us in life then to share that grace with others. But also, when you have really needed God, has he been there for you? Has he been there for you? Think about that in your life. When you have had needs and have called out to God, has he come through? Maybe he didn't always come through in ways that you expected. The Gibeonites, I suspect, were a little bit of a surprise to the Israelites. But God can come through in our lives. What an encouragement to keep calling out to him. What an encouragement to depend upon him with all of our being. And so my prayer for us today is may God richly bless you and keep you. And may God continue to shine his face upon each one of you for God's blessing this day. Let's pray. Thank you, dear Lord, for your great grace. We thank you for the Lord Jesus Christ. We thank you for including us in your purposes, and we thank you for that grace today in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.